Hooray, it's Friday. I love Fridays for so many reasons. 5 p.m. Friday, what's better than that? Triple happy hour,
yeah.
Right? Time for American at Radio on 90.3 WHBC HD. I'm Tom Ryan, and of course with me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales, Ryan, to keep
I'd
us...
I'd never leave you alone.
No, thank you. Thank God for that. God knows what I would do if I was left to my own devices. Of course, what we're going to be doing, what we always do, the How Music Changed series with a topic that we pick, and we basically go as deep as we possibly can into the topic. A recent topic, the one that we're covering today, is Pink Floyd. Today is going to be part six. Now, that's going to throw some people off, or maybe it's going to throw people off because of the previous two shows, which I said were part three and four. And that's because we did something new. It occurred to me that we covered an awful lot of Pink Floyd albums on our Wednesday series. And rather than be redundant, I thought it made sense to just bring them on over and we'll put them onto the website where they belong. So live, if there's a number that you didn't miss, I can tell you now that there is an entire show dedicated to the album Piper at the Gates of Dawn that we added to the website. And that's part three. And the previous two shows that we did before was three and four, which is now four and five. And going forward, you won't have to worry about that because I'll be dropping them in and I'll be telling you about them as they happen. So that'll make sense. So anyway, here we are with the history of Pink Floyd part six, which I can call A New Direction. Because at this point, I mean, although it was obvious that Syd Barrett would not be returning to the band, it was less obvious exactly what direction that the band themselves were headed in. As a unit. I mean, the uncertainty led to a whole new form that was basic to the musical ideas of the remaining four members, which left them all to be as experimental as they wished, while also maintaining a sense of inevitability about it all. Syd's gone, we've got to do something, and they are obviously very iconoclastic, all four of them. So they decided that they would basically just utilize what they had to make it work. And that's where we're at now. So a lot of the songs were truly strange, but they were also intriguing. And the audience, almost amazingly, held on and grew immensely, in fact. So that's where we are now. Pink Floyd, searching for a new direction, and we did cover a great deal of the soundtrack album More last week, but we didn't get to cover all of it, so I'd like to pick up with a couple of songs that we skipped that I considered to be actually perhaps two of the best songs on that album. The first one is a Roger Waters song called Green is the Color.
Heavy on the canopy of blue.
almost an unusual song for the band at this point in time. It's a pretty acoustic song by Roger Waters without all of the psychedelic undertones of a lot of the stuff that they were doing at this point in time. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the song was for a movie soundtrack, because at this point in time, like without Sid, the band didn't really know if they were going to be able to come up with enough material for them to do a thematic album of their own. And they figured that if they could maybe be a band that was officially providing music for movies, it seemed like it was like a part of their career that they might have like basically decided to continue with. Luckily, they were intelligent enough to realize that they could also take a lot of the songs that they're writing and use them directly for albums, and it worked out quite fine, as this show will tell as we go on. Now, there's one more song from... Oh, I also wanted to mention on that track, by the way, that flute song, the flute that you were hearing, it's actually a penny whistle. Nick Mason, the band's drummer, hasn't done a thing on this track. He doesn't appear, but that's his wife, Lindy, playing the penny whistle on that. So he gets credit for bringing his wife in to add something to the track. So the other song I want to play from this album before we move on is it's called Ibiza Bar. I guess a lot of Americans just want to say Ibiza and be done with it. But this is a song that sort of resembles a song that we played last week in part five, the Nile song. When I played that, I was like, wow, hard rock. You know, you don't think of Pink Floyd as playing hard rock. But this song has a very similar feel to it. Basically, another hard rock tune. And if you compare this to the that other track, the Nile song, you might find them to be like somewhat similar. So I'm glad that they're in different shows. Here then is a track written by the entire band, Roger Waters, Rick Wright, David Gilmour, and Nick Mason, and it's called Ibiza Bar.
I'm so afraid.
right. That's Abithabar. That's two tracks from the soundtrack for the movie More, for the film More. Some very interesting material on it. I'm usually very, very careful about the chronology and how I do the things with as far as putting them into a time sequence. But it's not that easy with Pink Floyd. And at this point in time, I'm sort of playing with the chronology because, well, I'll tell you why. Last week in our previous show, I played the A side of the single that the band released before they released the soundtrack for the movie More. I played the song Point Me at the Sky, written by Roger Waters and David Gilmour. I did not play the B side of that single, although I was very tempted to. The reason I didn't is because the B side was the song Careful with That Axe, Eugene. And since it's a single version, it was under 6 minutes in length. So it was really an edited or a shorter version of the song as it would appear on the band's album, next album, After More, which was the Umagumma album, which is where we are going. But then it occurred to me that, well, Umagumma is set up like this. It's a double album. And the first side is a live disc. And the second side is a studio disc. And the live disc is basically consists of four songs, two songs on side A, two songs on side B, that they had already released. And one of them is Astronomy Domine, which I did cover, absolutely, and also in the show that we just added to our set, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And we also did cover Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun, which is the other live song. The two that are on Umagumma, though, that we did not yet cover is Careful with That Axe, Eugene, and A Saucer Full of Secrets. So, what I want to do is play the Umagumma version of Careful with That Axe, Eugene. Now, according to David Gilmour, if you listen closely, Careful with That Axe, Eugene is basically one chord. As David Gilmour said, we were just creating textures and moods over the top of it, taking it up and down. Not very subtle stuff. There was a sort of rule book of our own that we were trying to play to, and it was largely about the dynamics. You will note exactly what he's talking about when you hear the Arthur Janov-like scream that is emitted by Roger Waters about midpoint in the song. It will give you chills. It's almost impossible that it doesn't. What is interesting is like the name, Careful with That Axe, Eugene. What does that mean at all? Which it's kind of odd. But if you look at the A side of the single that I'm talking about, Point Me at the Sky, that song begins with the phrase, "Hey, Eugene, this is Henry McLean." That was the first line. So maybe they're talking to that Eugene where they're saying, "Be careful with that axe." I'm not quite sure. But anyway, from the first album, Umagumma, or the first, yeah, of the two, of the double album that it is, here is the live version of Careful with That Axe, Eugene. Thank you. It almost vanishes. Except for the crowd, of course. That was a live version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene, which did appear on side one of Umagumma. Now, as I mentioned, Umagumma was a double album. Sides one and two were live tracks. There were four of them. And sides three and four almost definitely represent the most experimental and avant-garde music that Pink Floyd ever released. And if we're talking about Pink Floyd, that is really saying something. On the dark side, it's not an album that most people look back on fondly as far as the musical content. It's pretty difficult. But the album did go top five in the UK. And I think that a lot of it was due to the appeal of the album cover. The album cover was really attractive. It was the type of album that you really couldn't deny when you saw it. It was just a very colorful picture of the band. David Gilmour sitting in a doorway and with Roger Waters and the rest of the band like sitting on the grass outside of the door with a picture frame inside of the door. And in that picture frame is the same, more or less the exact same setting of the band, but in different order. They've moved to different locations. And inside of that picture is another picture on the wall that does it again and again and again. Sort of like what would happen if you put two mirrors up side by side. Very fascinating idea by Hypnosis. And I got one more track from the live side. But again, like I said, I was playing with the chronology of all of this. Well, I'm doing that here too, because we played a lot of tracks from the album, A Saucer Full of Secrets. But I did not play that specific song from the second album, mostly because I think that it was tedious. That's my opinion. But they did record the album, a live version, on the Umagumma album, which was, I'd say, significantly more energetic. And I liked that version. But just as I was about to do that, I realized that they recorded a version of the song also live in Pompeii, which was when the band got together for a movie shoot where they played on basically the Stones and a theater setting in Pompeii with all of their equipment and zero audience. A rather intriguing thing to do. It's probably, if you're a Pink Floyd fan at all, it's really worth trying to find it to see the film of the band playing in Pompeii. It was not released as an album for quite a while anyway. The movie itself, though, had a very interesting soundtrack, and they recorded a version of A Saucer Full of Secrets there. And I think it to be the best version that I had heard of the song, so I'm going to drop that here, because although it's not exactly chronological, this is where it seems to suit or fit best with the live side of the Umagumma album. So then here is a live version of A Saucer Full of Secrets, but I'm replacing the Umagumma version with the Live at Pompeii version. Thank you. Saucer Full of Secrets, that version from from the Live in Pompeii recordings. I'm replacing that there with the version for the album that we are covering, which is Umma Gumma. Now, I would say that the live side, oh, I should mention, by the way, that you are listening to 90.3 WHBC, WHBC HD, Garden City, New York. The show is American Hit Radio, and we are here every Friday from 5 until 6. We'll be covering Pink Floyd for a while. Right now, we're in the late 60s, which might explain exactly why the music sounds the way that it does, because there's no other time on the planet Earth when music like this could have been considered commercial, I don't think. It is by far the most experimental avant-garde album that Pink Floyd had made, and that's really saying something. But Umma Gumma really does fulfill that. It went top five in the UK. Like I said, maybe because the cover was great. But people were listening to it and appreciating it for, I guess, that whole, that psychedelic aspect of it. But I don't think it really held on with time, in my own opinion. Because now we go to the second record. And the second record was really a strange idea. It was recorded in the studio, of course. It was a studio album. And is by far the most experimental thing that the band did. They went into the recording studio, and their producer, Norman Smith, had asked them, have you got any songs? And they said, no. Oh, great. So what they decided to do was that they would take the four musicians, and they would allow each of them to play one half of a side of the album by themselves. So the first 12 minutes of music is solo Rick Wright doing a series of songs that he called Sisyphus, parts 1, 2, 3, and 4, which is really just essentially a 12-minute keyboard exercise with a tremendous amount of dissonance, freeform music, and it ends with like 7 minutes of really harrowing, like nerve-grating music. So I'm not going to play that. It's there. I told you what it is. You can help yourself. But I don't really think that that's, you know, necessary for me to do it at this point. Following that, on the end of side three, the second half, was Roger Waters, who brought in two tracks. One of them was titled Several Species of Small Furry Animals Gathered Together in a Cave and Grooving with a Pict. The song title's better than the song. And if you don't like the song title, you know what I mean. But the song before that was actually sort of Roger doing what he was doing on the album More, where he was playing some very nice pastoral ballads. And the song Grantchester Meadows fits the bill. So since I found it like less difficult to listen to, that's what I've decided to play from the side three of the album Umma Gumma. It's the Roger Waters composition called Grantchester Meadows. It's about 7.5 minutes in length.
I see wind of night begun, this is not your domain. In the sky, a bird was heard to cry. Misty morning whisperings and gentle stirring sounds belie the deathly silence that lay all around. Hear the lark and hearken to the barking of the dog fox gone to ground. See the splashing of the kingfisher flashing to the water, and a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer making for the sea. In the lazy water meadow I lay me down. All around me golden sunflakes settle on the ground. Basking in the sunshine of the bygone afternoon, bringing sounds of yesterday into this city room. Hear the lark and hearken to the barking of the dog fox gone to ground. See the splashing of the kingfisher flashing to the water, and a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer making for the sea. Flashing to the water, a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer making for the sea.
That, then, is from side three of Umagumma, Grant Chester Meadows, written and performed exclusively by Roger Waters. Now, on side four, the album ends with three tracks performing only by Nick Mason, the drummer. So I'm a drummer, but I really don't think I should be playing three songs on side four by myself. It's just kind of ridiculous. Although his wife, Lindy, does play flute on some of the tracks with him. So I can skip that part as well, which leaves us with David Gilmour. And I think that he sums up the record quite well when he says this: "We'd decided to make the Damned album and each of us to do a piece of music on our own. It was desperation, really, trying to think of something to do for me to just write by myself. I'd never written anything before. I just went into a studio and started waffling about, tacking bits and pieces together. I even asked Roger Waters for help, at least with the lyrics, and the reply that he told me was, no, do them yourself." Later on, David Gilmour would deem the whole recording a pretentious waste of time. His parts were called The Narrow Way, parts 1 to 3. Here's part 1 of David Gilmour's The Narrow Way. Right then, that leaves us with room for one track, and actually, this is actually the band itself, for a change from where we just came from. After, actually, it wasn't released. It was an album, a song that was basically only available on compilation albums. It's a song called Embryo, written by Roger Waters, and it's literally about an embryo becoming a fetus and eventually a baby. It's actually kind of interesting, and we'll end with this. See you next week, folks.
Whisper love.